You know what that is?
Yeah, we call it McGavia too.
Do you?
The head of the Secret Service in the line of fire of tough questions from lawmakers over failures to secure the White House and late-breaking revelations of another security lapse. Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff. Gwen Ifill is away. Also ahead this Tuesday, tens of thousands of protesters continue to peacefully fill the streets of Hong Kong, calling for more freedoms from China and defying government demands to disband. Then, violin virtuoso Joshua Bell returns to perform at a Washington, D.C. train station. But this time, people take notice. Plus, in California, an impossible choice for the families of patients on life support with little chance for recovery.
I really believe that if my wife could answer, you know, do you want to stay alive or do you want to die? I believe that she would say that she would want to stay alive. I believe that.
Those are some of the stories we're covering on tonight's PBS NewsHour.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by...
At BAE Systems, our pride and dedication show in everything we do. From electronic systems to intelligence analysis and cyber operations, from combat vehicles and weapons to the maintenance and modernization of ships, aircraft, and critical infrastructure. Knowing our work makes a difference inspires us every day. That's BAE Systems. That's inspired work.
I've been around long enough to recognize the people who are out there owning it. The ones getting involved and staying engaged. They're not afraid to question the path they're on. Because the one question they never want to ask is, how did I end up here? I started Schwab for those people. People who want to take ownership of their investments like they do in every other aspect of their lives.
BNSF Railway.
The William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives.
And with the ongoing support of these institutions. And
this program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
We begin with breaking news this evening. For the first time, Ebola has been diagnosed inside the United States. Dr. Tom Frieden of the Centers for Disease Control announced late this afternoon the patient was infected in Liberia and is now in an isolation unit at a Dallas hospital.
It is certainly possible that someone who had contact with this individual, a family member or other individual, could develop Ebola in the coming weeks. But there is no doubt in my mind that we will stop it here.
U.S. hospitals have treated several other patients who contracted Ebola in West Africa, but were diagnosed before returning home. There has been another breach of presidential security, this time in Atlanta. The Washington Post reports that a security guard with a gun got on an elevator with President Obama during his visit there 2 weeks ago. It turned out the man also had three convictions for assault and battery. A supervisor fired him on the spot, and that is when agents discovered that he was armed. Lawmakers from both parties went after the head of the Secret Service today over security breaches at the White House. Julia Pearson was grilled for 3.5 hours and said she takes full responsibility. Pearson had hardly settled into her seat before House Oversight Committee Chair Daryl Issa bore in.
This failure was once again tested the trust of the American people in the Secret Service, a trust we clearly depend on to protect the the president.
The failure in question came when Iraq War veteran Omar Gonzalez jumped the White House fence on September 19th and made it well inside the mansion. Today, Pearson, a 30-year Secret Service veteran, issued a mea culpa.
It's clear that our security plan was not properly executed. This is unacceptable, and I take full responsibility, and I will make sure that it does not happen again.
What's publicly known about what happened has changed dramatically in the 11 days since the intrusion. The Secret Service initially said Gonzalez sprinted across the front lawn and passed a guard booth and dogs, but was stopped just after entering the north portico door. It is now known that, in fact, he continued to run through the central hall and into the ornate east room before he was tackled by an off-duty Secret Service agent who, it turns out, just happened to be there. The Secret Service has said agents showed tremendous restraint and discipline in apprehending Gonzalez. But Republican Jason Chaffetz of Utah argued today that is nothing to be proud of.
I want it to be crystal clear. You make a run and a dash to the White House, we're going to take you down. I want overwhelming force. Would you disagree with me?
I do want our officers and agents to execute appropriate force for anyone attempting to challenge or breach the White House.
There were also questions about why agents failed to take action after Virginia police found guns and a map with the White House circled in Gonzalez's car in July. Massachusetts Democrat John Tierney.
I mean, you didn't take any action. You didn't have him arrested. You didn't have him continue to be under observation, did you?
Mr. Gonzalez, at the time, denied any interest or any intent to harm anyone. He indicated that his information relative to the map in his car was given to him by another individual who had recommended places in Washington, D.C. to sightsee.
Pearson was also asked to explain revelations in the Washington Post that it took the Secret Service 4 days to realize a gunman hit the White House 7 times back in 2011. Maryland Democrat Elijah Cummings cited one of several agents who decided against contradicting their boss's view that the shots were not directed at the White House.
She did not challenge her supervisors for fear of being criticized, she later told investigators. Now, Director Pearson, as a former field agent and as the head of the agency, that has to concern you tremendously. Is that right?
Yes, sir, it does. It's unacceptable.
But another Massachusetts Democrat, Stephen Lynch, charged that Pearson's overall responses were simply evasive.
And I wish to God you protected the White House like you're protecting your reputation here today.
Let me be clear. The United States Secret Service does not take any of these incidents lightly. They are all of extreme...
With all due respect, that's my point. If, as a casual observer to what has happened here, I don't think the Secret Service is taking it their duty to protect the American president and his family at the White House. I don't think you're taking it seriously.
Still, the White House said again today the president is confident the Secret Service will implement any reforms needed.
The accused fence jumper, Omar Gonzalez, was indicted today on federal and state charges. President Obama hosted India's new Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, in a bid to repair strains in relations between their nations. The two leaders focused heavily on resolving trade disputes and improving economic ties, and the president praised Modi's policies.
I've been impressed with the Prime Minister's interest in not only addressing the needs of the poorest of the poor in India and revitalizing the economy there, but also his determination to make sure that India is serving as a major power that can help bring about peace and security for the entire world.
Modi was once barred from entering the U.S. after Hindus killed more than 1,000 Muslims in the state where he was governor. Across central Iraq, car bombings and other attacks killed at least 47 people today, most of them Shiites. While to the west, Iraqi and Syrian Kurds drove Islamic State militants from a key border crossing into Syria with help from Sunni fighters. In Syria, Kurdish fighters and their allies battle to hold Kobani near the Turkish border. The conflict has sparked an exodus, as the United Nations heard today.
Over the past 2 weeks, ISIL forces have advanced in northern Aleppo, and over 160,000 people, mostly women and children, fled into Turkey in just a few days. Their fear was so great that many people crossed heavily mined fields to seek refuge.
Also today, British jets launched their first attacks against Islamic State targets in Iraq. They joined the latest round of strikes by U.S. jets. The world has lost half its wildlife population since 1970. That's stark finding today from the World Wildlife Fund. It reported a 52% decline, centered in several thousands of species. And it said humans are largely to blame through fishing, hunting, and pollution. Most of the new wildlife losses were in Latin America. California will impose the first statewide ban of single-use plastic bags. Governor Jerry Brown signed the legislation today. It's designed to cut down on bags getting into waterways. The ban applies to large grocery stores next year and expands to smaller stores later. More than 100 American cities already have such bans. A decision today by the Federal Communications Commission will be welcome news for many sports fans. The FCC voted to drop a decades-old rule that bans showing hometown games on TV if they are not sellouts. It was meant to protect ticket sales, especially of NFL games, but the FCC found that rule is outdated. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 28 points to close below 17,043. The NASDAQ fell 12 points to close at 4,493. And the S&P 500 slipped 5 to 1972. Still to come on the NewsHour, protests swell in Hong Kong demanding more democracy. Afghanistan agrees to keep thousands of American troops in the country. Fears of another volcano eruption rattled Japan. Violin virtuoso Joshua Bell busks for commuters in Washington, D.C. Mississippi's Senate race divides the Republican Party. And the painful decisions facing families with loved ones on life support. Protests grew in Hong Kong and brought parts of the city to a standstill for a fifth day. And there was no sign that the pro-democracy, student-led demonstrations will stop anytime soon. Lucy Watson of Independent Television News has this report from Hong Kong.
There is little that this huge crowd won't endure. The umbrella revolution and the fight for freedom is unrelenting. It's an unprecedented display of defiance. People in every direction taking over a city. There is strength in numbers, but also in individuals. 3 days ago, Gary Lee was an ordinary student. Now he's rousing an historic crowd.
Everybody put your cell phone the light on. Cell phone the light on.
To fulfill our dream, we'll sacrifice everything, they sing. They want their current leader, CY Leung, to step down and to elect another freely, demands they refuse to give up on.
Never see the end, never see the end, because this fight will forever.
And as China's President Xi Jinping prepares for the country's National Day tomorrow, this is a direct challenge to his governance.
They were not expecting the Occupy Central movement to become, I mean, what is now a popular uprising. Then they worry that people are going to imitate this.
Threats the Communist Party is unlikely to respond well to. But while there's persistence, there's hope here.
For more on what provoked these protesters and how mainland China is likely to respond, we turn to Ian Bremmer. He is the president and founder of Eurasia Group. It's a political risk, research, and consulting company. Ian Bremmer, welcome to the program. Are these protests unprecedented? Has China ever seen anything like this? And I guess Tiananmen comes to mind.
Yes. I mean, Tiananmen's the last time we've seen this sort of thing within China itself. Certainly Hong Kong, there's been nothing like this since the handover from Great Britain in 1997. And most importantly, it is by far the first serious challenge domestically to President Xi Jinping. It really is directly a question of the legitimacy and the support of what's so far been a very popular, very charismatic, and very transformative rule.
Well, how much of a challenge is it to him and to the regime, the government in Beijing? These students have been there for 5 days. They don't show any signs of backing down.
No. And in fact, tomorrow, as you've heard, you have the National Day. There have been a number of calls for demonstrations in support of the Occupy Central movement, not just in the United States and in developed countries, but we also see that they're likely to happen in Macau. They're going to happen in Taipei and Taiwan. And it would not surprise me at all, despite the fact that the Chinese government has really tried to crack down on anyone searching relevant social media terms around the Hong Kong protests within mainland China, to see some forms of sympathy there. And that's one of the reasons why I think Xi Jinping, who's been very willing to engage in policies of economic transformation on the mainland, but has had absolutely no interest in political reform. This is not a glasnost guy. He's very unlikely to show any flexibility whatsoever, as is the Hong Kong government in responding to these protests. Occupy Central has now become Occupy Hong Kong. As of tomorrow, it's likely become Occupy larger than that. And if local police, through threat and selective arrests, are unable to disperse these demonstrations, we're likely to see a very significant violent crackdown.
Well, what do you mean by that? Because that's the natural question. If these protesters are not going away and the government, the central government, isn't going to bend, what does that mean?
Well, I mean, the initial step comes from Hong Kong itself. We've seen the Hong Kong leadership completely refusing to even meet with the leaders of the Occupy Central movement, never mind brook any compromise about what suffrage in selection of a chief executive in Hong Kong might look like in 2017. I think the next steps clearly involve the police, who have been relatively quiet over the last couple of days. They can certainly take steps to try to remove who they see as the ringleaders of that movement. And after they've done that, to try to pressure, the broader groups, give them a couple of outs, let them disperse once their leaders have been taken under custody. But again, if we continue to see this type of mobilization among the students that poses a much greater threat to the legitimacy of the Chinese enterprise and to their power, their exertion of power in Hong Kong, I think the response goes beyond just Hong Kong police. Then the People's Liberation Army does indeed come in. They have garrisons in Hong Kong. I suspect they'd be used. Certainly, the international community can complain, but there's no potential that sanctions or punishment is going to be exerted against the Chinese government for what they do internally in Hong Kong. This is not like Russia versus Ukraine.
So just very quickly, you mentioned the international community, Britain's Prime Minister Cameron protesting today. Of course, they previously held Hong Kong. You're saying there's nothing anybody in the outside can do?
Oh, I think that Cameron and Obama will do a great impersonation of Ban Ki-moon. I think they will express a great deal of concern over what happens for Hong Kong. But if you ask me, are we talking about the potential of sanctioning them, I'd want to just go back to what former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said, which is that it's generally not a good idea to criticize your banker on human rights. It's going to be very, very difficult for anything more than words in response to what's happening on the ground in Hong Kong.
Ian Bremmer with the Eurasia Group, we thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you. The United States and Afghanistan signed a bilateral security agreement today, which will keep a limited number of American troops in the country. The long-term deal will allow U.S. and NATO soldiers to carry out counterterrorism missions and to support Afghan forces. Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent Margaret Warner has the details.
The signing ended months of uncertainty over what happens when the U.S.-led international mission officially ends December 31st. U.S. Ambassador James Cunningham.
The United States values its relationship with Afghanistan and the Afghan people. We are committed to a better future for Afghanistan.
More than 2,200 American troops have died in the Afghan war since 2001. At their peak, U.S. forces stood at 100,000 in 2011.
It was inserted like this.
The new deal will leave 9,800 Americans and about 2,000 other NATO forces there to train and assist Afghan units. Newly inaugurated President Ashraf Ghani said today Afghan sovereignty won't be compromised.
The international forces are not allowed to enter in our holy sites and our mosques. Integrity of our life and houses will be safe based on our constitutional values.
For months, former President Hamid Karzai refused to sign the accord. Both Ghani and his presidential rival, Abdullah Abdullah, supported it, but their drawn-out election dispute prevented its signing. During those months of uncertainty, the Taliban stepped up attacks and regained territory in the north and south.
So how important is this security agreement? Jeffrey Brown explores that.
And joining me is Barnett Rubin, former senior advisor to the Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan at the State Department. He's now director of the Center on International Cooperation at New York University. Thanks for joining us. So start with that very question. How important was it for the U.S. to get this agreement and why?
It's important because it allows us to manage the transition toward Afghan self-reliance on security much more effectively. The Afghan security forces still require a great deal of U.S. assistance and logistics expertise, and above all, I should say, funding. And keeping those forces there makes it much more likely that they will obtain all of those.
Given the sensitivities that Margaret Warner just referred to in all of this, remind us exactly what these troops will do. We refer to a training and assistance. What does that mean exactly?
It means that, some of them will be working in headquarters. A few of them will be working at division level in the field, though they will not be engaged directly in combat activities. But there's a lot more to running an army than fighting. There is record keeping, logistics, targeting, definition of strategy, and so on. Those are all things in which these advisors will help them to maintain and develop their capabilities. In addition, it will give us additional eyes on the ground to help us understand the political evolution there as well. Now, this is not a permanent deployment. President Obama has said that this advisory mission will last at most 2 years. It will have one other mission, which is what they call counterterrorism, but that will be limited to targeting those groups that specifically target the United States, in particular, whatever remnants of al-Qaeda there may be in Afghanistan. It won't be part of the effort against the Taliban.
And I wonder now, with a new president, is there a sense that the U.S. has a real and reliable ally in Ashraf Ghani as opposed to Hamid Karzai?
I think that both Ashraf Ghani and his chief executive, Abdullah Abdullah, supported this agreement, and both of them have been quite consistent in their views. So I think that they will represent the interests of Afghanistan, which are not always the same as the interests of the United States, but they will be easier and more reliable to deal with.
And I suppose looming question for a lot of people as we watch what goes in Iraq is, what lessons have or should U.S. officials learn from that when they look at our Afghan policy now and develop that?
Well, I think one lesson they should learn is not to compare Iraq and Afghanistan, because in the past, falsely, the Bush administration drew the conclusion from the rather rapid collapse of the Taliban in Afghanistan, that they could have a similarly easy victory in Iraq, and that was totally wrong. Iraq is a middle-income country with oil revenue. Afghanistan is an extremely poor country. I think, of course, the general lesson that you should try to maintain stability in your relationships is valid, but it was, after all, President Maliki in Iraq who refused to sign an agreement such as the one that President Ghani has signed in Afghanistan today.
All right. Barnett and Rubin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
In Japan, rescue efforts at the Mount Ontake volcano have been hampered by toxic gases and fears of another eruption. On Saturday, more than 250 people were out hiking and enjoying a nice fall day when a surprise eruption littered the mountain with falling boulders, thick smoke, and piles of ash. At least 36 people were killed, and questions have been raised as to why there wasn't more warning. Here to help us understand what's happening, our science correspondent Miles O'Brien and Thomas Wagner of NASA, who is an expert on volcanoes, and we welcome you both. Miles, to you first, why was it? Was this as unexpected as we're reading?
It was, Judy. This was what's called a phreatic eruption, which means it was shallow and involved some hot water, essentially, steaming water that entered into a crevice and came in contact with magma, which, of course, is many thousands of degrees, causes like an instantaneous flash like you'd have in your oven, and caused that pyroclastic flow to come out. This is not the kind of thing that all those sensors, which are on that volcano, and Japan has well-censored volcanoes, this is not the kind of thing that they predict well.
So, Thomas Wagner, when it comes to predictability, they're not always this unpredictable, are they?
No, it depends what's going on in the volcano. Like in a place like Hawaii, you've got big bodies of magma moving around. They cause the volcano to deform and tilt. But eruptions are difficult things. You can think of a volcano like a big, crazy plumbing system in a big old building.
And you were telling me that there are many different kinds of volcanoes active right now around the world, but they're operating at a different speed.
Right, in a way. And some volcanoes, like the Japanese volcanoes, have a lot of water dissolved in the magma, and they have more explosive eruptions, just like if you shook up a soda bottle and took the top off. Whereas at Hawaii, you don't have a lot of water, and you get more lava flows.
So, Miles, clearly these deaths, 36 deaths, tragic. But for the volcano itself, how significant an eruption is this?
Well, this is scientists will be looking very closely at what may lie ahead here. If you'll hearken back to 1980, Mount St. Helens, before the huge eruption there, there was a series of these phreatic eruptions, these eruptions involving boiling water. And they were viewed as a precursor to the eruption which we ultimately saw, which caused such devastation in that part of the world. So volcanoes are in some sense predictable, but in some sense not. You can see a lot of the warning signs. It's very difficult to know when they're going to blow. I mean, think of the island of Montserrat, and that island had dealt with evacuations. Half the island is now completely evacuated, but it lingered in a state of near eruption for many, many years. There were many questions to scientists saying to them, why can't you figure this out better?
And Thomas Wagner, just continuing with that, is it easy to predict when it settles down by watching it?
No, because you get different kinds of eruptions. And so, like, that's why in some cases we use satellites to look at how a volcano deforms. In other cases, we'll actually have people go out and map the old deposits around a volcano to figure out what its history is and where you might be likely to get another eruption. And the hazards are different, too, right? In this case, we had a phreatic eruption. In some cases, a tiny eruption melts snow on top and makes a mud flow. One of those killed 20,000 people in South America in the 80s. And sometimes you get lava flows. And that's why it's important to sort of understand the particular hazards around the volcano you're on.
And Miles, you talked about what scientists learned from this. What are scientists looking at here?
Well, what they're going to do, and as I mentioned, the Japanese have a well-censored volcanic system, if you will, as well as great ability to predict earthquakes as well. This is a nation that kind of lives on the knife edge when it comes to seismic activity and volcanoes. So they'll be looking at those sensors, seeing what was damaged, putting in the types of devices that will allow them to further analyze it. At the time of the hike, it was considered safe to be there. It was level one out of a scale of 1 to 5 as in the safe end for hikers to be in proximity of that volcano. Over time, they'll not be as generous with that rating as they consider the possibility that this could be a precursor to something bigger.
And very quickly, Thomas Wagner, here in the U.S., nothing quite like this?
No, we have like Mount Rainier. We have all the Cascade volcanoes. The USGS, though, has a great program monitoring those and studying those. And there are really good maps of the hazards that people should make themselves aware of.
Well, this is certainly, if you didn't have a reason to do that before, you do now. Thomas Wagner with NASA and our own Miles O'Brien. We thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome, Judy.
Did you hear the one about the famous violinist who played in a subway station and no one noticed? Well, it was a different story today, and Jeffrey Brown was there.
It was a sight that almost no one watched as it happened, but gained much attention afterwards. A superstar of the classical musical world, Joshua Bell, playing in a metro station in Washington, D.C. in 2007. Largely ignored by a few thousand commuters on their way to work. An article by Gene Weingarten of the Washington Post about the event or non-event won a Pulitzer Prize. Now 46, Joshua Bell has been performing in the world's greatest halls since he was a teenager, and he's recorded more than 40 albums, including a brand new one of compositions by Bach. But something about the subway performance captured the imagination of many and apparently of Bell himself. Because there he was earlier today at Washington's Union Station Metro. This time, though, the performance had been publicized. Bell brought along a group of young musicians he's been working with for an HBO masterclass program. And with word out that this was no mere busker asking for a few dollars, a crowd was on hand. Bell joined us to talk soon after.
So it was better this time?
A lot better this time.
A lot better.
Yeah, this was fun. I actually really enjoyed it. I didn't enjoy it the first time around that much, but it was, although I was amused the first time around.
Well, wait a minute. Why did you not enjoy it?
Music really... You need the give and take from the audience and the feeling of attention it's not about me. It's not about my attention to me. It's about the music itself. You know, part of the reason why I accepted to come here at the invitation of the Union Station is that they said this time we're going to tell people about it,
yeah.
Spread the word, and hopefully you'll get a captive audience. And I said, you know, this is precisely what the whole original experiment, which was not a scientific in any way, that's really what it was about.
It all kind of raises the question of how classical music should or could be presented, right? I mean, should it be done in different venues? Should you try out different things? Should you reach people in different ways?
Well, I think I'm always interested in reaching people in different ways, not by just standing randomly on a subway platform
with your case open.
With my case open. That's not really a great way. But this is an example of I think this shows that there is interest in classical music from a wide range of people. I felt like one of the Beatles today. This is great. People.
Well, you almost got the hair.
I don't normally get that kind of response for, you know, people grabbing at me in the stage. It was so fun for me. But I think we need to experiment with more creative ways of reaching audiences.
What about the idea, and I was thinking of this as they started clapping after the first movement. Sometimes there's this discussion in classical music circles, you know, should we encourage people to clap? Should it be a less formal experience?
Well, first of all, people, if you go back 100 years or 200 years when the music of Mendelssohn was being performed, people did clap after the first movement. You know, when Beethoven's Seventh Symphony was premiered, after the second movement, they clapped so much that they had to repeat the second movement and do it again. I mean, so there was a different kind of vibe. And so when people today say, you're not supposed to clap, I actually say, you know, it's historically actually incorrect. And I enjoy when I hear people clapping at the wrong times, I think that's great. We've got a listener that's not used to going to, but we got a new listener, and that excites me.
Yeah, but you don't want to discourage
charge that, right?
So do you? I don't. I've had conductors playing with conductors that turn around to the audience and say, "Don't clap," you know, and then I'll usually turn to the audience and say, "Come on, do it."
We often hear about the crisis of classical music, right? About the aging audience, about the. Do you sense that, or what do you see?
Well, I think people have been talking about the aging audience for 100 years now, and they somehow people keep replacing those older people. Because I think the problem is that, I mean, classical music, so often we come to it late in life as you're looking for something in music that's not just about being trendy and what's popular, but something that's profoundly affects you. And I think great classical music and jazz and other things, there's no reason why we can't reach younger people. And I'm not pessimistic about it. I think look at the young people there today. And
there
I see
a lot of them, aren't there?
After every concert, I greet young people in the lobbies, and I talk, and I see a huge surge of young people playing music. So, but I think where we need to work on is getting it, making sure that it's just part of everyone's educational diet in the school. You know, music and art is part of what it means to be a human being, and to make it just an extracurricular thing is sad, because most kids will not get any musical experience if they don't have it in their school at some point.
And yet that is happening in a lot of places.
It's happening, and that's what I'm spending a lot of energy trying to encourage change in that way. I'm working with Education Through Music, which is ETM, which is an organization that puts classical music programs in, or just music programs in inner city schools that have no music programs. And we've seen incredible, the test scores go up all across the board. Their self-esteem of these kids that have an instrument in their hand and play together. If anyone saw that, they would think it's ludicrous ever to cut out music from your school. And I hope people will get that message.
Speaking of young people, you yourself started as such a young person.
I did.
You have been at this a long time. Do you feel a pressure to keep, I don't know, finding new ways to do new repertoire, new approaches, new venues like this?
It's not a pressure. It's just for me, it's the music world and the things that I want to do is so huge that it's just the only thing that makes me sad is that there's not enough time in my lifetime to do all the things I want to do.
Are you done with subway stations for now?
I think this is a perfect end to the whole story. There have been a lot of chapters that were unanticipated. There's a children's book about it. There have been sermons from preachers and ministers and politicians who've referenced and it's been kind of fun following the journey, but this, I think, was a perfect kind of cap ending to the story, and I couldn't have been more pleased with it.
All right, Joshua Bell, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me today.
In the battle for control of the United States Senate, this summer's primary contest in Mississippi exposed deep divisions in the Republican Party that still haven't been reconciled. Jeffrey Hess of Mississippi Public Broadcasting has our report.
The Republican primary was won by Republican voters.
42-year-old State Senator Chris McDaniel is the energetic young face of Mississippi's Tea Party. The Sarah Palin-backed McDaniel came within a few thousand votes of beating six-term incumbent Republican U.S. Senator Thad Cochran in a June primary and subsequent runoff by riding a wave of anti-Washington, anti-incumbent anger. McDaniel claims election fraud helped Cochran win, and is challenging the results in court. According to McDaniel, Democrats voted in their own primary and then illegally crossed over and voted in the Republican runoff, which is a violation of state law. McDaniel blames the state's Republican establishment and the Cochran campaign for attempting to stop the Tea Party in its tracks.
They were willing to sacrifice a friend for power, and they would say or do anything they had to do that, and they did. That's problematic, but not just for me, because when they called me those nasty names, when they called me a racist, which is not true, when they said I was going to cut off funding for historically black colleges and universities, which is not true, when they said I was going to end welfare and suppress voting rights, which is all not true, they were likewise saying it about 187,000 conservatives.
The contentious primary here in Mississippi was the most high-profile example of the primary battles that have taken place across the country between the Tea Party and establishment wings of the Republican Party. In 2010, the Republicans rode a wave of Tea Party support to retake the House. But many Republicans with ties in Washington believe that the Tea Party cost them seats in the Senate. And with the Senate up for grabs again this year, they were determined not to let that happen again and they spent millions to make sure of it.
But staunch McDaniel and Tea Party supporters aren't giving up the fight.
It split, this race split the Republican Party in half, basically is what it did. So you've got, basically I told a guy the other day, there's a McDaniel sticker still on my car. I said, pretend that's my name on there. And everything that happened to Chris happened to me.
Mississippi Tea Party Chair Laura Van Overschild says they are unlikely to endorse or campaign for Senator Cochran in the general election against his Democratic opponent.
We endorse Chris McDaniel because he holds those truths. That we should have a limited government, we should have fiscal responsibility, and we should have free markets in this country. And Thad Cochran has not shown us by his voting record that he endorses any of those.
Repairing the rift between active Tea Party supporters and more mainstream Republicans is the challenge facing Mississippi's GOP Chair Joe Nossef, who says it's time to move into general election mode.
You can't continue to move the bar every time a different election comes up and create a litmus test for what you call a real Republican. I asked somebody the other day, I just said, you know, my only, as we were parting, I just said to him, my only hope is that you wouldn't vote against your own best interest in an effort to try to get somebody back that ran an ad you didn't like.
The Republican nominee will face off against Democrat Travis Childers, a former congressman from the state's 1st District. Polls in the state have repeatedly shown Cochran with roughly a 15-point lead. Cochran won by almost 25 points in his re-election 6 years ago. DeAndre Ori, a political science professor at Jackson State University, says it would be a long shot for Childers to beat either Republican, but that Tea Party supporters do have a choice to make.
I mean, the Tea Party electorate could do one of two things. They can get out to vote so that the Democrat does not win, because that's a very, very plausible case if they don't get out to vote. Or they can stay home and show, in their opinion, how much power they have. And so the question is, one of those two being the answers, I just don't know, because I don't know what they will do.
Cochran would be a strong favorite to retain his seat in November, in part because of his broad appeal. In fact, in his primary, he was able to turn out black voters by reminding them of his record bringing back funding to the state and warning about what McDaniel would cut. Former Governor Haley Barbour's nephew is one of the orchestrators of that strategy, which enraged Tea Party activists. Barbour himself, who's often sided with creating the Republican infrastructure in the state, feels confident that Tea Party supporters will remember that they are Republicans at heart.
Anytime you have a vigorously contested primary, some people are going to get their feelings hurt. Some people are going to pick up their marbles and go home. But most people come back because of what they believe in. In the Obama administration, has followed policies that are so far to the left and so antagonistic to what Republicans, whether they're Tea Party Republicans or been Republicans for 50 years, those Obama policies are so bad that people are not going to stay home.
Democratic candidate Childers says he does not think the intense Republican primary will have an effect on the November general election. He says he's not concerned that his affiliation with the Democratic Party will drag him down.
People are far less concerned about party, Jeffrey, in the state of Mississippi. They're more concerned about who is going to work for them and who's going to stand up for them, who's going to stand up for Mississippi and who's going to stand up for Washington, D.C.
But time is running out. The party and Cochran campaign need to shift into general election mode to remind their voters that there is still a race to run in November. Cochran campaign spokesman Jordan Russell says they're moving on, confident that their primary runoff victory will stand.
Well, no, I mean, we're campaigning. We're out there. You know, I think we've been in 42 counties over the past couple of weeks. We're moving forward. The campaign itself and Senator Cochran are not focused on the challenge, the legal challenge. We're focused on November, focused on making sure people understand the difference between Senator Cochran and his challenger. And, you know, the court case will play out as it plays out.
The state Supreme Court is scheduled to hear McDaniel's appeal to a lower court's decision to throw out his challenge to the runoff results. In the meantime, ballots are being printed that list Senator Thad Cochran as the Republican nominee to be the U.S. Senator from Mississippi.
And finally tonight to California. We have partnered with iNewsSource, a San Diego-based journalism nonprofit, to take us inside special nursing home units there where thousands of people live on life support. The state spends millions of dollars on this type of care designed to preserve life at all costs. Families often have high hopes for their loved ones to recover. but few ever will. iNews Source reporter Joanne Farrion reports on the impossible choice facing these families, when to let go.
You know me. Your husband. Your husband. You know me. You know me.
Steve Simmons spends most evenings by his wife's bedside.
Does that hurt? Does that hurt your ear?
Rafaela Simmons is severely brain injured.
Squeeze my hand. Squeeze my hand if you love me.
She has a feeding tube in her abdomen, a tracheostomy tube in her throat. She is unable to walk or talk or respond to the world around her.
Squeeze my hand. Squeeze my hand.
She has lived in this nursing home for the past 4 years.
You can do it. Squeeze my hand.
Rafaela is one of the 4,000 people living in units like this in California. On the books, they're called subacute units, but among some doctors, they're known as vent farms because so many of the people who live here need ventilators just to breathe. The average age of these residents is 56, but there are units devoted just to children. They are the end of the line, the place people go once medicine has saved them, but where there is little hope for recovery. Ed Kirkpatrick is the director of the Villa Coronado Nursing Home in San Diego County.
The drive in the system is to be able to repair and fix anything. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing. We want that to happen. At what point, though, does it become futile?
The Villa Coronado subacute unit is one of the largest in California. Most of the 62 men and women here don't react to people or stimuli, touch, sound, smell. They have not tasted food in years. Some have had strokes, others traumatic brain injuries, falls and fights, car and motorcycle crashes.
It was a beautiful day in February. It happened to be Valentine's Day, 2010, and I love riding my motorcycle. I mean, I rode it.
Steve wasn't going very fast that Sunday morning. Rafaela was on the back of his bike when they were hit by a car. She was thrown.
But I don't know, you know, how high she went. I don't know at what angle she came down. My friend saw it, but I've told him, don't tell me. I don't want to hear.
Like everyone on this unit, Rafaela needs constant care. She is turned to avoid bed sores. Her tubes are cleaned and flushed. And there is this, the routine suctioning. People with tracheostomies are unable to cough up mucus that gets trapped in their lungs. Dr. Ken Warm is Rafaela's doctor.
I feel it every time I see it, how frightening it would be to have a tube in my lungs. Someone's doing that to me and I can't move my arms to push it away. Reflecting on that can be horrifying.
This level of care is expensive. It can range from about $500 a day to as much as $900, depending on the nursing home. Medi-Cal, a state program for the poor and disabled, pays for most of it. More than $630 million last year. That's almost double over the past decade. The state of California established these units back in 1983 to save money. Keeping people on ventilators and feeding tubes is even more expensive in an intensive care unit than in a nursing home. Joan Tino is a professor at the Brown Medical School. She is an expert on medical care for the dying.
I was kind of shocked. I started looking at it and I thought, this is like a Robin Cook book. You know, it's like a vent farm.
Robin Cook wrote Coma, a medical thriller about brain-dead patients being kept alive. Tino says the financial incentives in the medical system are aligned with doing more at the end of life, procedures and hospitalizations, rather than letting go.
We pay for another day in the ICU. We don't pay for a physician to sit down and have that really difficult conversation with that family about what would your mother want under these circumstances.
Those conversations were politically dubbed as death panels in 2009 during the debate over the Affordable Care Act. Under the original health care proposal, doctors would have been paid to have end-of-life conversations with their patients. That provision was eventually removed from the health care bill. According to a recent Pew Research study, 66% of Americans say there are some circumstances in which doctors should allow patients to die. 31% believe they should do everything medically possible to save lives in all cases.
I've heard that so many times in my career. Do everything. Do everything. Okay. We will.
Often, people are making those decisions under duress, or they're making it for someone who doesn't have an advance directive, a document stating their medical wishes. After the accident, Rafaela spent nearly a month in an ICU, teetering between life and death. Doctors told Steve his wife would probably never recover and offered hospice. But a neurologist who was consulting on the case told Steve Rafaela was a fighter.
He gave me a little bit of hope. He gave us hope.
In California, a patient or their next of kin can stop treatment or disconnect life support at any time. They can even withhold food and water. But deciding whether a life is worth living and making that decision for someone else, a parent or even a child, can be agonizing.
Maria would throw them deliberately at their feet so they would break.
Some people on this ward have a progressive illness, like Maria Curcio. She was born with severe cerebral palsy. Nancy Curcio is Maria's mother.
She has the feeding tube, urostomy tube, and the trach.
Maria is 54 years old. She has lived in this nursing home room for 10 years. She has kidney problems, respiratory failure, and a right hip so badly contracted it required surgeons to cut through bone for relief. She has never walked or talked.
It's getting hotter and hotter because basically if I was in that condition, I would give it up.
Nancy has had to make life and death decisions for her daughter from the time she was born. Doctors sent her home to die because she couldn't suck from a bottle. Nancy fed her drop by drop. 10 years ago, Maria needed emergency surgery.
One doctor stopped me in the hall and said, Mrs. Curcio, we cannot do the surgery unless we do a trach. And I had seconds to make up my mind. And then I looked down at Maria, and she's looking at me like, hey, what are you thinking about? You know, I don't want to die. This is me.
There are times when Maria smiles and she looks more like the happy little girl in so many of the Curcio family photos than the middle-aged woman she now is. Or she tries to spell the word mom.
M. Thank you very much.
For Nancy, these are signs her daughter wants to live.
I cannot pull the plug on somebody like that who expresses the fact that they're not ready to give it up.
Dr. Warm has done a lot of reading about grief since he started working at Villa Coronado, trying to understand why some people are unable to let go. He believes they grieve in the same way as someone in search of a missing person.
Here they sit with the moral obligation to bring their family member back. And though I might say the hope of their return is extremely low, they can't let go of that extremely low probability.
For Steve Simmons, it's been a four-year vigil that at times has driven him to the brink, like when his wife's feeding tube was clogged for the fifth time and staff had to put a tube down her nose to feed her. He couldn't bear to watch.
And I said, one of these days, oh, it's terrible what I said, one of these days, I'm going to bring a shotgun in here. And what I really meant is I meant that, you know what, I'm going to come in here and blow my brains out in front of all of you. Because I can't endure any more of this.
Rafaela has made small improvements in the past year. She is able to sometimes squeeze Steve's hand or grasp a ball. Dr. Warm continues to tell Steve that Rafaela has little chance of recovering. But to Steve, these small gestures are affirmation he's made the right decision to keep his wife alive.
I really believe that if my wife could answer, you know, do you want to stay alive? Or do you want to die? I believe that she would say that she would want to stay alive. I believe that.
What would she want if it was you?
Oh, if it were me, I'd want to go. I'd want to go. I wish it were me. I wish it were me. Yeah. Yeah, I wish it were me. Yeah. Yeah. Asked for that so many times.
Again, the major developments of the day. The Centers for Disease Control announced the first case of Ebola diagnosed in the U.S. The patient is now in an isolation ward at a Dallas hospital. And the Washington Post reported that a private guard with a gun and a record of assault and battery got on an elevator with President Obama 2 weeks ago. The disclosure came after a House committee grilled the head of the Secret Service. On the NewsHour online right now, for artist Wendy Smith Wood, living off the grid has its perks. She gets to live amid the stunning beauty of the Alaskan wilderness and is 75 miles away from the nearest village. It's all served as inspiration for her work, silks that she dyes in the glowing rivers of glacier mud. See how she does that on Artbeat. All that and more is on our website, newshour.pbs.org. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. On Wednesday, we'll look at Buddy Cianci's bid to come back as mayor of Providence, Rhode Island, after spending time in prison. I'm Judy Woodruff. We'll see you online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us here at the PBS NewsHour, thank you and good night.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by... Economy for 160 years. BNSF, the engine that connects us. Charles Schwab, proud supporter of the PBS NewsHour. And by BAE Systems, inspired work. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting science, technology, and improved economic performance and financial literacy in the 21st century. And with the ongoing support of these institutions. And
this program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.